David Vann wanted to be a writer, and he wanted to be a sailor. And he thought he'd found the perfect solution when he saw the steel hull of a 90-foot yacht in a shipyard on the coast of Turkey. The plan was he'd buy the boat, fit it out, and then take people on educational cruises around the Mediterranean, show them the sights of ancient Greek civilization and the stories of the Odyssey, and he could spend half his time writing on board his beautiful new boat. It didn't pan out that way. In fact, what happened was just so terrifying, it threatened to swallow him whole. And just when it seemed like things couldn't get worse, David's troubles doubled and then doubled again. The whole scheme came so close to killing him. It also came close to destroying his sense of the man that he wanted to be. David Vann wrote about all this in a memoir that was called A Mile Down, and when I read it, I kept thinking, oh my God, I wonder if he lives, which is silly, because he got to write the book. But since the disaster at sea, David Vann has become a very successful author of fiction. He's the author of Legends of a Suicide, Caribou Island, and Dirt. His most recent novel, Goat Mountain, is quite amazing. And just a heads up before we get started, today's conversation is going to feature some stories that involve guns and gun violence, which some people may well find distressing. Hello, David. Welcome.
Thank you.
The book Goat Mountain is dedicated to your Cherokee grandfather and his ancestors who hunted on Goat Mountain. That's what it says in the inscription. Where and what is Goat Mountain?
Goat Mountain is the hunting ranch in California where we went every fall. And this was the most sacred land for my family, for the men in my family. This is where all of our stories were told and retold each year and where our history was kept. So as we'd walk around each part of that ranch, my father or grandfather or uncle would tell the stories of who had been there and what had happened. It actually was something that prepared me in a way for doing a story in the outback out of Alice Springs. I went out country with an Arunta man and his ritual caretakers, and it was so beautiful to see and hear about that idea of singing up the land and of belonging to a place and having your stories and your history there. So I experienced it in a much more limited way, but it still was a place that was so important for us.
Do the Cherokee have a tradition of bringing stories into the land and stories coming out of the land and being bound into the land as well?
Yes, they do, but I can't really claim to be Cherokee in that my grandfather didn't say that he was part Cherokee, and so he never told us, and we didn't know. And yet the men in my family only make sense with that heritage, really. So it's been a strange experience for me to have discovered late that that was our background, but then have it make sense of that background and also make sense of my writing. It's interesting that you can be affected by traditions that you don't even know about.
The main character in your book is an 11-year-old who doesn't have a name. In fact, I think only one person in the book has a name all the way through. And at the beginning, he sort of feels like he's arrived too late for the land. The land has been depleted. It used to have deer, bucks running through the place. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like that when you were taken as a kid to go?
I did. I had this very strong nostalgia for the world that my father and uncle had grown up in, that they had lived in a land that was more populated by animals, that hadn't had so many people come in and hadn't had everything depleted. And I felt that I had arrived just maybe 25 years too late to experience this other world. And it actually is true in terms of how populations went. There was an enormous change during that time. But there was also some nostalgia to it. It was an atavistic wanting to reach back to some earlier culture, some earlier time, wanting to not be in the modern world in some ways.
The singular event right at the start of the book that sort of gets things going is when this boy, his father and grandfather and a family friend are on this ranch and they see a poacher, and they see him at quite a distance through the scope of this boy's father's rifle. The boy is invited over. He's 11 years old to look at the poacher through the scope. He squeezes his finger on the trigger and shoots him dead. Afterwards, these men treat the boy like there's something badly wrong with him, because he doesn't feel that sense of sin for having shot a man at a distance. I really felt for this kid, because I think when you're 11, that's not uncommon to feel that way. I think you're a bit psychopathic when you're 11. Other people's feelings are a bit fictional. What do you think?
It is a frightening time in that you don't necessarily have a solid ground for morality and ethics. As a kid, I felt that it was slippery to know what was good and bad. My father did have me look through the scope of his rifle at poachers on our land, each fall when we'd arrive, it was a kind of a ritual on arrival to open the gate and enter the land. Quite a few times there would be a poacher up on the hillside there, and they wore orange vests so you could see them easily. And several times my father had me look at the poacher through the scope of his 300 Magnum rifle, which is a rifle meant for shooting bears. You know, it's a huge caliber. And he would have a shell in the chamber with the safety off. So all I'd have to do is tap that trigger, and the man would be dead. And it was like there was something in my father that was willing this to happen. You know, it was a kind of test. I was put on the edge, and it really felt like I was standing on the edge of a cliff, that feeling you get that maybe you want to go over the edge, when I was, you know, looking at this man through the scope and had my finger near the trigger.
How old were you when you were given your first rifle?
Well, I was given my first pellet gun at 7, and then I was given a shotgun at age 8, 20-gauge shotgun. And then my first proper rifle, a 30-30 carbine Winchester, like in the Westerns, that was when I was 9 years old. That is what I ended up shooting my first two deer with when I was 11.
Was this a coming-of-age experience like it is in the novel?
It was. In this novel, there are real experiences that have been transformed, and these were the most defining and important but also upsetting experiences that I had as a child.
Were you longing to kill your first buck?
I was. I remember thinking that 12 years old seemed impossibly far away, and I so badly wanted to be 12 because I thought you had to be 12 to be able to shoot your first deer. And by law, that is how old you're supposed to be. My family went ahead and skipped the law and let me go ahead and shoot them at 11. But I remember just pining away for getting old enough to when I could shoot my first deer, and shooting at wooden targets before that. And the feeling of wanting to become a man, to find my place alongside the men in my family.
Was that the whole of it, wanting to become a man and having your status raised in their eyes? Or was it the actual act itself that you were longing to do?
It was the thrill of killing something large was certainly a huge part of it. We had something that we called buck fever, which is that when you sight in on a deer with a rifle, you can feel the blood pounding in your temples, and that's all you hear. You lose all other sound. In fact, when you shoot the rifle, you don't even hear it go off. You just hear this blood in your ears. And your heart is like this rock. It becomes so hard, and it's just yanking away in your chest. And you don't really feel the rest of your limbs. It's a suspended and strange state. And it's just the pure thrill and adrenaline of killing, the desire to kill. And it's killing something large enough that it's like a person. You know, this deer was bigger than I was. It was as big as my father. And to become a man, to become a part of the family, and to kill something larger than myself, that was all so thrilling and so much what I wanted to do. Part of what's scary to me is the legacy of Cain, not only as a bad thing, but as something that's desired, that's wanted, that thrill of the hunt and of killing.
How did that first deer present itself to you?
Well, it was really mean. The weekend I shot my first deer turned out to be a rainy weekend, and it's a mean kind of hunting because the deer don't like to get wet, so they don't like being out in the brush. So they come in and stand around under the trees. And so we were driving in the pickup truck, and I was standing in the back, and when you'd see a deer, you'd pound on the top of the cab, and the driver would lurch to a halt, and then you'd shoot right from the back of the pickup. And so that's what happened with the first deer. I shot it from the back of the pickup with the 30-30, and it wasn't far away, and I hit it right in the neck, and it just went straight down. And I was so excited. My father and grandfather and uncle all had this special whoop that was only for when you kill a deer, and it was especially excited because it was my first one and my coming of age.
There's a special whoop? There's like a rebel yell or something,
yeah,
is it? Or something,
yeah,
that's
it was
only
like
for
a
when
yell.
You kill a deer?
Yeah, and I can't even remember what it is anymore. I mean, it's been so long now, but it was only for that. You wouldn't hear it at any other time. And it was, you know, pure thrill and excitement. It was, my father was depressed, and the other men in my family were depressed also. But in this kind of moment, they became so excited and so alive. It was a part of them that you wouldn't see at any other time. This is when they sort of came into being. So we went leaping over the side of the truck, running through all the ferns and fallen growth and stuff to get to the small stand of trees where the deer was. And then I just felt so overwhelmed with how wrong it was to see the deer there with its eyes still open, lying there looking like Bambi, you know. And it felt so deeply wrong. I was very upset by it.
So you initially in shooting it, you felt you'd done something that was so deeply right.
Yeah.
And then encountering the body of
it. Then very quickly, something felt so wrong. But the next day, I shot my second deer. And that deer, I shot from much farther away, and I wounded it in the spine. I shot it in the back. So it was paralyzed from the back half of it down. And that was more disturbing because my father had me come up, walk up right behind it, and put the rifle to the back of its head and execute it. And it felt like executing a person because it was afraid and it was looking around and could see me and it couldn't move, it couldn't get away. And that was a more disturbing experience. And that was so disturbing that I never shot another deer again after that or anything large. I mean, this felt like I had committed some, terrible, deep, atavistic crime, something that would stain me forever that I wouldn't be able to get free of. And I felt, broken and polluted by it. And because of its suffering, because it was paralyzed but still in pain from the parts that could feel, because the bullet goes in one place and comes out another, and then having to execute it, it just felt very wrong. So after that, I shot at imaginary deer. We'd be out on a hunt, and I'd get very excited at a deer that didn't exist. I would imagine it out in front of me and leaping, and I would rise up and take shots at it, and the blood was pounding in my temples. I had buck fever, and then the men of my family would come running, and we'd try to track this deer, and the deer never existed.
All of this is in Goat Mountain, too. There's also another scene involving the ritual after killing the animal and the deer. Did you do that as well with your first deer?
I did have to gut the deer and then eat the heart and liver. And
what, take the raw liver and the raw heart from the still warm organs from the deer's body and consume part of it?
Right. In Goat Mountain, I describe gutting the deer and eating the heart and liver raw, and that being the ritual that makes a man. The father and grandfather both say, "Now you're a man." And that is what happened in my family, except that I did get to have it fried up with some onions first. So I fibbed a little bit on that part. But the gutting of the deer, in none of my books do I want to horrify a reader or describe something gross or something. But I think that rituals are important to describe because they're linked to an older time and culture and an older world. Ritual is what makes the horrifying normal. It makes these terrible things that we do seem okay and seem fine and seem part of our humanity, not something that's brutal. And the ritual of the gutting of a buck is important because it's so involved, and it involves various aspects of how it is that you treat a deer. So cutting away his manhood, for instance, but also not spoiling the meat. So having to be so careful about getting the sack of urine out of there without letting that spill on anything. The careful way the tip of the knife is used to not slice into the guts to release any bile, which would again get into the meat. It's very ritualized. It was our kind of church. And the camp that we stayed in, everything that we did had that kind of resonance to it.
I know it's an odd thing to say, but is there something about the way the deer is treated after it's killed that feels like, is there a feeling you need to honor the dead beast?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was honor. And we never drank during hunting. We didn't do anything illegal except that I shot deer at 11 and I should have been 12. And we ate the deer and we kept the hides and the horns. And there was this idea that you have to use all of it. And there's a reverence in gutting it and treating it afterwards. And so that's part of what becomes confused in the book about the difference in reverence toward a buck or toward this poacher that the boy kills. What are the difference in the rituals? Is there a difference?
This is a dream you had of going to sea at an older age, which you kind of inherited from your father.
Mm-hmm.
You grew up in Alaska with him and your mum, and he was a dentist. Why did he want to give that away to become a fisherman?
He hated being a dentist, and he did it only because his father was a dentist and because he felt that he needed to make a lot of money and support his wife and children. He ended up breaking up two marriages through infidelity, so the idea of keeping the family together turns out wasn't very strong for him. But it was strong in that he felt very guilty about having broken up families twice and being unfaithful. But what he loved to do was fish, and his last desperate attempt at changing his life was when he had a commercial fishing boat built, a big 63-foot aluminum boat that was beautiful, and he went fishing for albacore off Mexico and for halibut in the Bering Sea in Alaska. And that was a beautiful dream that he did with his brother, my uncle, that they went to sea together. It was a foolish dream, like my own later, in that they didn't hire a captain with experience. They didn't trust old-timers who said that the big drum on the back that pulls the line in should be steel, not aluminum. And that aluminum drum did end up crumpling, and that's why I went out of business. They also weren't prepared for the conditions. There are 30-foot standing waves in the between the Aleutian Islands and ice building up on the top of the boat, so it was becoming top-heavy. They came very close to dying and were very frightened by that experience. But my uncle still remembers the whole experience as thrilling, and he has no regrets, because they were out together in this place that was mysterious and kind of miraculous. They had these odd experiences, like one night the boat was veering off to the side, and they couldn't figure out why that was. They checked out all the systems, and nothing made sense. And eventually it seemed that maybe there could be otherworldly forces involved, you know, that they were pulled into some kind of zone.
Like a triangle thing, or a giant kraken under the
right.
waves.
It felt like them, that, yeah. My uncle said. They really could not figure out what it was, and they started to, in their minds, they started to believe supernatural explanations. Finally, they went out. Side in this terrible weather and managed to see that one of the spreaders that put out to the side in the water to help stabilize the boat had caught a buoy that had come loose. And that was slowly dragging them to one side. But until they found that, my uncle said it was a fantastic moment because other explanations became possible. The world opened up and became something else.
Once the fishing business on idea failed for your father, his boat sank actually at some point, didn't it?
I come from a family of sinkers. I'm the fourth man in my family to sink a boat. So my grandfather sank a...
I don't know what to say.
Well, every family has to be good at something. my grandfather had an old wooden converted Navy cruiser to take church groups out singing on the lake in California. And these were beautiful times that they would sing and play cards, and that one went down, but luckily without the church groups on board. And then my father had a brand new small sport fishing boat in Alaska, and he was so proud of it. And we took it out in the harbor on the day we launched it, and then went home at night, came back the next morning, and we're standing on the docks looking down through this clear, you know, icy water to looking at his boat. It looked like this beautiful mirage sitting down there on the stones.
Well, it just sank straight away.
It sank right away on the first night.
What, how do you do that? How do you sink a boat on the first night?
It's quite a trick. It's the drain plugs. There are these little plugs in the back that when you get water in the boat, this will help the water drain out. But if you leave the plug out, of course, water just drains back in. And over enough time, overnight, it can sink it. So my father was so embarrassed by this that he told my mother that it was a branch that had gotten caught in the exhaust and held an exhaust valve open. But that's what my family was. It was all lies. And that was wonderful for becoming a writer. My family lied about everything, the big things and the small things. So it was the size of the fish and what happened in the hunt and this branch in the exhaust. And it was also who broke up what marriage and why and who was responsible for whose suicide. You know, we had the big lies too.
So your father had to go back to dentistry, which I'm sure depressed him no end.
He did. After that adventure, commercial fishing, I think it was depressing for him to go back to dentistry. And it felt like there's probably no other chance or no other way out. And when he killed himself, he was alone in Fairbanks in a house, a big new house he had built with no furniture, no family or friends or neighbors, in the middle of winter with no light. And I think that he felt just that his life had become small and lonely and wasn't going to get better, didn't have much possibility to it anymore. And he'd already kind of tried his big thing at sea, and it didn't work.
When he killed himself, he was divorced from your mother, had remarried again, hadn't he?
Mm-hmm. And divorced again.
He was on the phone to your stepmother when he killed himself.
Oh, it was terrible for her. She can't answer a phone with her right ear anymore. It has to go to the left. She was in California. He was in Alaska. She had met another man and was planning to be with him. And my father felt very wronged by that. He became very angry in the end. He used the word shafted, that he felt shafted by her, which is a very violent kind of word in his final notes. And he was blaming her for his despair, as men often do, and and not thinking clearly, as someone about to commit suicide is often not doing. And I think that he actually had fantasies that maybe the insurance money would help us and that would be better for us. And he called her and he told her, "I love you, but I won't live without you." And she couldn't hear well in the office, so she had to go behind a door and ask him to repeat what he had said. And then he said, I love you, but I won't live without you. And then she heard the shot. I mean, it was really horrible for her. And the thing about disturbing moments is that we can't experience them even at the time. So she imagined that it was the sound of like a salad bowl, because it was a metallic sound, the gunshot, and that, you know, maybe there were, she wasn't sure what those other sounds were, the dripping sounds. And her mind refused what was happening at the moment. She couldn't make sense of it. And this happened for the people who watched the school shooting also, who were there in the hall when this shooter I wrote about killed 5 students and wounded 18 and then killed himself. None of them could identify what he was wearing or what he looked like. He had a graphic of an AK-47 assault rifle on his t-shirt, and that was in red. And so some people thought he had red hair. Some people thought his pistol was silver, like in the Westerns, but it was black. So no one at the time, they didn't have time to lose memory. The event was actually so disturbing that they couldn't see it or experience it or process it, even in the moment it happened. So my father's death was like that for my stepmother, and especially because 11 months before, she had lost her parents to murder-suicide. Her mother had shot her father with a shotgun in the back as he was running away.
Well, hang on here. Your stepmother, she'd lost both her parents in a murder-suicide?
That's right. And that's why his suicide, making her hear it, seemed especially cruel to me. Because she had just been through this terrible incident with her parents. So her father was leaving his wife, her mother, saying that the last 15 years of marriage had been a lie. He had been having an affair. He was going to move on without her. And she planned her suicide, and she wrote suicide notes, including to her husband, didn't plan to kill him. But he had a large gun collection, as a lot of Americans do, a lot of shotguns, a lot of pistols. And so she picked a shotgun and a pistol one day and shot him in the living room and killed him with the shotgun and then killed herself with the pistol. And this was so upsetting for my stepmother, especially since my stepmother hadn't gotten along with her mother and it all was unfinished. It was so tragic. And then 11 months later, just as she's putting together a new life with this new man and moving on from my father, who hadn't been faithful to her and had been helping him a lot for weeks through his depression and talking with him many times a day to help him get through this, then he kills himself on the phone that way. And then he sent her gifts, which arrived like 3 days later on her birthday. She got flowers from him.
He'd sent her flowers before he'd killed himself.
Yeah. And it's so awful. I feel so bad for her. And she'd had many other deaths in her life too. And she's very strong, and she's helped me write about my father when I was writing Legend of Suicide. And she eventually did break. She went into prescription drugs and had too many of them, and her life really fell apart for about 10 years. And then she pulled out of it, and she's good now. And I really love her and love talking with her, and I think she has the clearest view of my father and my family. But I just can't believe the thing that she had to experience there.
You were 13 when this happened, when your father did this.
Yeah.
How were you told, David?
We had just been to the beach in California, my mother and sister and I, and we came home, and my mother had a phone call, and it was clear it was a death. It was terrible, and she kept saying, "Oh no, oh no," and we thought that her father had died, who was in the rest home, but then she was saying strange things like, "My children, oh no, my children," and she took us to sit on the couch, and she told me, your father is... I can't remember exactly the words. It was something like, "Your father shot himself." And I think I said, "What, in the foot?" Like, I refused to believe what clearly was happening. And she said, "No, you know, he's dead." And the terrible thing was that my sister didn't understand. She was too young. I was 13. She was only 8. So I went running back into my room and locked the door, but then my mother made me open it up that I couldn't be alone during that time. We had to be together. And then I saw when my sister finally understood, and it was like her face just crumpled. Like, it was just kind of like when I would shoot birds and they'd just be kind of blown back in air with the wings back. And it just, it was, that was the most terrible moment for me. You know, I love my sister, and it was just awful to see her recognize that he was gone. So it was an awful moment. And I know that when I write fiction that's about based on family tragedies, sometimes people say it could be dark or depressing or hard, but it's actually tremendously reassuring to read about these things in tragedy because it's all made meaningful and coherent. In real life, it was just so terrifyingly meaningless. There was no shape to the air or our lives or anything. That my life couldn't restart. It was hard to care about anything. We couldn't enter the world unconsciously again to live our lives. And in fiction, it's all coherent. It's all meaningful. It's all made beautiful, actually. And I think it's reassuring. The writing for me has been wonderfully redemptive. It's been a second chance to go back and visit all those things that were most difficult and turn what was ugly into something beautiful.
On ABC Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler, on air, online, and on your mobile.
My guest today is David Vann. David is an author of many books. His most recent novel is called Goat Mountain, and he's also the author of a book called A Mile Down, which is the story of his absolutely disastrous career at sea. David, before you were telling us the awful story about your father's suicide, after you'd been told about that, what was your overriding feeling?
The main feeling was that there was no meaning in the world anymore. I love tropical fish. And I had fish tanks, and I remember I just wanted to smash them in because I didn't care about them anymore. And I couldn't go to school for a couple of weeks. My sister went right away, and she and my mother both had these nice kind of moments in dreams or imaginings of my father saying goodbye to them. But for me, he was just gone, and there was no meaning to it and no shape, and I couldn't re-enter the world.
Were you clearly troubled, or were you putting up a good face?
Well, I told everyone he died of cancer for 3 years because it was so shameful, his suicide.
And shameful? Why? Why shameful, do you think?
It's a violent act, killing himself with a pistol, you know, blowing off part of his head. It felt that the violence of that and the dirtiness of that extended to me, that it was my shame. And that's a common experience after suicide. I've now talked about suicide and suicide bereavement in probably more than 20 countries around the world, and I've been so amazed to hear that everyone has the same experience.
Really? There's a feeling like that there's a stain or something on the family.
Exactly. It's so
really
shameful. There's really
But you haven't done anything. Why do you feel
right,
that?
Right. I mean, no one should feel ashamed by it, but we do. And it's partly because it's hard to talk about suicide, and it's something most cultures would rather keep quiet. But there's also a feeling of guilt. Everyone feels responsible. My father had just asked me to come spend a year in Alaska with him, to come and spend a year together, and I said no. And then soon after is when he killed himself. So I thought maybe if I said yes, he'd still be alive. And so that's in the background of Legend of a Suicide, which describes a boy and his father going homesteading for a year in Alaska. It's a kind of second chance. And of course, we're not actually responsible for someone else's suicide, but we feel the guilt anyway. And rage. I felt so angry at him for more than 30 years. And I felt doomed for about 20 years to repeat what he had done. I felt that suicide would just be waiting for me.
Did it create a kind of a black hole you felt you were being drawn into?
It did. It felt like no matter how I led my life, no matter who I was or what I did, eventually I'd hit a low point and suicide would just be waiting for me then. It was a sort of appointment in the future that wouldn't be broken. And when I hit that low point, I would just be ambushed, that suicide would be waiting for me, and it would be irresistible at that point. And that was my fear, that we have to repeat our parents' lives, that my father's life had a kind of gravity to it that would pull me in.
When you were grappling with all this as a teenager, while you might have been presenting a good face to school, what were you doing at night?
Well, I had a double life for 3 years after my father's suicide. I was a straight-A student. I was in band and student government and sports, and everyone thought that I was fine. And my mother was a school counselor, so she thought that she could tell whether or not I needed counseling, whether I was okay. And I seemed completely fine to her, so she didn't have me go see a therapist. So guns became my therapy. My family thought it would be a great idea to give me all of my father's guns after he had just killed himself with a gun. So I'm 13 years old.
What?
And they give me a 300 Magnum rifle for shooting bears. I already had the 30-30 carbine, like in the Westerns. They gave me his 12-gauge shotgun, like the police have, and I already had a 20-gauge shotgun.
Does this speak in some way to a bit of a blind spot the United States has towards guns? I mean, all these violent gun deaths in your family, and
right.
as a kind of comfort to you, they want to give you your father's guns.
Right. I've fought a lot against the gun movement in the U.S. now. We have 300 million privately owned firearms in the U.S., and we have shootings all the time, constantly. And as I was writing about the school shooter, it was clear that we make mass murderers and school shooters. We make them in volume. We have 1.2 million American veterans seeking mental health help and mostly not getting it, an article in the New York Times. And many of those would fit perfectly the profile of a mass murderer, who's actually very easy to profile. They're all the same. They're all men. Women don't do this. They're young. They don't have a lot of money. They have right-wing politics. They're all libertarian. They have mental health issues and aren't getting great help. They have access to guns and like guns. The military has trained them to kill without feeling anything. That's part of what I was exploring in Goat Mountain, is how is it that you can kill and not feel bad? You know, that's the question. That's the legacy of Cain. And that's a question the U.S. has to come to terms with. We've trained everyone in our armed forces to kill without feeling anything. But what about when those people come back to live with us?
So there you are, an angry, alienated teenager with your father's guns. What did you do with them?
Well, I had this secret life where at night I would break his 300 Magnum rifle into pieces and stuff it in the back of my jacket and ride my bicycle out into the hills. And then I'd reassemble the rifle and I'd shoot out street lamps, sometimes from a couple hundred yards away with a 300 Magnum. And then
in the middle of the night?
Yeah, in the middle of the night, I'd be shooting out all the lights in the neighborhood. And so you'd hear this big boom.
With a high-powered rifle?
Yeah, it's a huge boom. It's an incredible, it sounds like artillery. I mean, it's really, really loud rifle. And no one ever came. It was strange. And I would aim at people through their living room windows. I would aim at them with the scope, with the shell in the chamber and the safety off. And I think I was very close to pulling the trigger. I hated everything about my life, and I had no friends. I lost all my friends because of my dad's suicide, and they were making fun of me every day. I had all that kind of alienation that a lot of the shooters have. And I was aiming at people all the time. And I was also sneaking into their houses after school. It was just before answering machines on telephones. And so I'd just call a neighbor and leave the phone ringing the whole time I was there. I'd go in through their bathroom window, which was always left open a little bit for ventilation, and go in over the toilet head first and go in and look at all the stuff they had. And I think I was just trying to see what the inside of other people's lives were, because mine was empty. So I cataloged all of their stuff. And I didn't steal anything, but I just wanted to know what they had.
When you looked at people through the scope of your rifle in the middle of the night, what did you see them doing?
Mostly drinking in living rooms, sometimes reading. It would have been terrible if I shot a reader.
What did you think of them as you looked at them through the scope? Did you have any opinion of them?
It was really strange. There was the same thrill of the possibility of pulling the trigger, the same thrill I'd felt with deer. The hunting is a terrible training in that it makes it possible to kill something large and makes it exciting. And so there was some part of me that wanted to pull the trigger, and that was what was really scary about that time. And I knew that if you do anything illegal with other people, you'll get caught. So I did everything myself, so I wasn't talking with anyone about any of this. The guns really were my therapy. It was just aiming at people and shooting things. And shooting their houses was the step in between. I would shoot their fireplaces, for instance, like their chimneys. And that was one step closer, not just the street lamps, but shooting the houses. I couldn't shoot the people, but I'd shoot their stuff. It was such a dangerous, scary time, and I feel so grateful that I went through that time and didn't hurt anyone and also didn't go to prison. I didn't get caught. So, I mean, the worst would have been hurting someone, but it also would have been terrible to have my life constrained to, you know, something after getting caught.
After school, you went to Stanford University, graduated, but then you were just scratching out a living. Why was it so hard to scratch out a living in those years?
Well, I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I was making $27,000 a year to teach full-time at Stanford, and a house, just a crappy, like, old house, small, the cheapest you could get was about $800,000. So I had no hope of ever being able to put together sort of a normal life with a house. But I also couldn't really afford rent even. It was $1,000 a month just to rent a crappy place, and I was making $27,000 a year. So I really was struggling, and I freaked out a little bit because I realized I was going to spend the rest of my life below the poverty level, unable to really pay the bills at the end of the month. At the end of the month, I'd be down to like $20 and have to like not eat so I could pay a bill, you know? I just didn't want to live that way forever. And I couldn't get a professorship because Legend of a Suicide, although I'd finished it, agents wouldn't send it to publishers. So,
is there a problem with the title? I mean, that would be one of those things.
They didn't
think
it would sell because of the strange format. It's a novella framed by five stories, and also the fact that suicide's in the title. And it was so funny. Colm Tobin asked me in an event in London, "Well, why didn't you just change the title?" And when he asked that, this was just a couple of years ago, I realized it had never occurred to me. I actually never thought of just, well, maybe I could change the title, you know? Like in Germany, they called it In the Shadow of the Father. And that would have been fine. I could have just titled that. Maybe I would have been published 12 years earlier. You know, I worked on it from when I was 19 till I was 29, and then revisions till 30, and then it wasn't published till I was 42. So maybe I never would have gone to see.
I know we're not supposed to believe in artist therapy, and I certainly don't. Nonetheless, was that act of writing about that, writing a parallel story to your own, was that a way of making you feel better? Did you feel better from that process?
Absolutely. I think that art is wonderful therapy. I think it's important to distinguish between the two, that art is something more than therapy, and that both are about truth, but art is about the beautiful. It has a different goal. In therapy, you don't have a goal of transforming the ugly into the beautiful. Your goals are other goals. So that's the difference.
So you're a young man in your late 20s or thereabouts, in a somewhat fragile state, living kind of hand to mouth. Mm-hmm. And feeling like you've got this appointment with doom to meet a similar doom with your father. Mm-hmm. And you're in Turkey and you see the hull of a 90-foot yacht. What does that do for you, the sight of that hull?
That hull was incredible. It was a dream. I dream of books and boats. Those are my two dreams. And from growing up in Alaska and seeing boats all the time and my father's interest in boats. And this was like, it was two stories high. And it was 90 feet long. It was like Noah's Ark or something. It was like, you know, my salvation was in that boat. I just had to have it. I imagined an infinitely larger, more expansive life on board that boat. You know, the places I will go and the things I will do. I mean, it's hard to describe because it sounds so stupid.
No, it doesn't at all.
I really fell for it. I mean, I had already been running charters. I'd already had this dream of putting together my love of boats and being on the sea and teaching creative writing classes on board sailboats and having time to write. I'd done it with a smaller boat first in San Francisco and then taking up to near Seattle, the San Juan Islands. And I'd run a wonderful summer of charters where it was so fulfilling. You know, these wonderful, smart adult students came on board and they wrote short stories and we talked about literature and we had olives on the back deck and walked on the islands, you know, these beautiful landscapes. And it felt like the dream was all coming together. But I'd had disasters in Mexico. My boat had been abandoned by another captain in a drug running port and I lost a lot of money on it. I'd almost died. I'd had a pistol put in my face and been rammed by pirates and had prostitutes beaten up in front of me and threatened by the Navy and almost taken to prison. And I mean, I had this terrible time and I was deep in debt financially and that boat could no longer pull me out of my debt. But this bigger boat, by increasing the scale of the business, it had a chance to save me. Really, it was salvation also. I could have 16 guests. I could make a larger profit with it and I could possibly pull out my debt. So I did it partially out of fear also because I had to somehow get out of that debt.
How much, in all honesty, is self-deception at work here too? Insofar as like, I've had this terrible time with the boat. What I need to is a bigger
more,
one.
You're more getting a bigger possibility boat. For destruction.
That's right. Something that's even harder to handle and take care of. And it's got to be built as well. And of course, and in all seriousness too, in the back of your mind is your father's own disastrous experience where he tried to put beside a boring life that meant nothing to him to pursue this dream of becoming a commercial fisherman. And it failed. And the failure haunted him. And then he met this awful death by his own hand. You felt you had this appointment with your father's doom. Was this a way of running towards it?
I think it was. I think I was actually heading toward disaster to push myself into that position to test whether or not suicide was or really waiting for me. I think that's actually what I was doing. You know, I was like a moth to flame. And I should have known, of course, that a bigger boat would just lead to bigger disasters after I'd had small disasters with the small boat. I definitely should have known that.
So you get through this long, lengthy process. You get all these loans to build this big boat that you're going to charter. The Turkish crew that you've got to build this boat rip you off blind, and you go into a huge amount of debt. And I just feel this kind of knot of anxiety just reading about you going through this, David, I have to say. Eventually you get it out to sea, and it's problems. All the paint falls off the one side of the boats. There's a problem with the navigation. All sorts of problems go wrong. You get it out onto the Atlantic, just off the coast of Morocco. And what goes wrong there? Tell me, go through that night where it all goes to hell in Morocco.
Well, the waves and wind started to come up, and I was wakened by a terrible loud bang right under the bed where I was sleeping. And It was our rudder coming loose. The rudder was still attached, but the ram that was supposed to control it had come loose somehow, which isn't supposed to happen, obviously. We're in big seas. It's so difficult to control. I have these great Alaskan fishermen as crew, and we managed to get an emergency tiller on it up on deck, tied off with lines. And through the heroism of one of my crew members, we actually managed to get that hydraulic ram screwed back on. I mean, it was so hard to get that fitting still and get these tiny threads to line up in big seas, and it was a nightmare. But we got it back on, and the boat seemed fine, and I changed course to head to the nearest port so we could get it checked out and any repairs. And I thought things were going to be okay. And then, in the middle of the night, I wake up again to the same kind of sound. And this time, we're spinning a circle, and the ram that I can see is moving fine and hasn't come detached. And so that means there's no rudder down there.
Well, the whole rudder.
The whole rudder
just
is gone,
dropped off.
Has sheared off. And it's like it's like the tail on an airplane, and it's just gone flying down to the bottom of the ocean. And so we're just spinning in circles. And, of course, now it's 50-knot winds, 20-foot seas. It's a storm. And it began 10 hours of the most grueling time, where each hour I thought, this is the worst time of my life. It can't get any worse than this. And then the next hour would be substantially worse than that hour was. And it was three towing attempts, trying to get up behind a 300-foot German freighter for them to throw a line to us in the storm and tie it off and get towed. But the German captain was intentionally going for a salvage claim. So he wanted to destroy our boat and get us to abandon ship so that he could then claim part of the value of the vessel after he would tow it and take it back to port.
So the German captain of this 300-foot-high freighter puts all your lives at risk to force you, he gives token efforts to help you, to force you and the girlfriend who's the love of your life and other passengers to abandon ship in high seas, in treacherous conditions, just so he can steal your boat.
Exactly, because he had done this to another boat before, and it's a lot of money. It's
what a
more
scoundrel.
Than they usually make. And his first mate, too. Later, his first mate was so mean, he was like, "You stupid American, it's a big world out there. We are smart, and you are not." I mean, they just told me straight up what they were doing. There's no mystery to it.
Now, what happened when the Moroccan Coast Guard came to rescue you?
That was even better. The Coast Guard came out in a helicopter, and I shouldn't be saying anything because they were out to rescue us, right? Which is very nice of them to do. I appreciate that they did that. But they didn't bring a radio, so you couldn't talk with them in any way. And they dropped down a diver who was completely out of shape. I mean, you could see beneath the wetsuit a really huge belly and skinny arms. And he was really struggling in the waves. He didn't know how to swim very well either. Even though he had fins and mask and snorkel, my Alaskan fisherman who was in the water to be rescued ended up having to prop this guy up because he was drowning.
One of your guys needed to save his life.
Yeah, was trying to save the diver's life and then got the diver back to where the diver could be rescued by the helicopter. And then they took off and we never saw or heard from them again. And now my fisherman's in the water and we have to throw lines to him and try to bring him back on board safely. I mean, it was ludicrous, the kinds of things that happened.
Well, we're laughing about this now, but I'm not really doing any justice to the absolute perfect terror of this moment. It's not funny at all
in
the moment.
Retro- retrospect, but at the time, I just couldn't believe. I mean, that's one special thing about a boat. On a boat, when things go wrong, you can never hit a point where you think, okay, forget it. I've had enough. I'm leaving. I'm not doing this anymore. In a boat, you get to stay. There's the storm. It gets worse. It's night. Things keep breaking. You keep having to do stuff. And there is no chance to leave. You just get to stay.
It's like it's just an apocryphal story from a friend of mine, who was a woman who was giving birth. And about 6 hours into her labor, she said, "Everyone, I've got an announcement to make. I can't go through with this, and I'm leaving." It's like
exactly.
That, isn't it?
It's exactly like that. Although I think childbirth is probably much more grueling, more painful than anything I've gone through. But it was awful that we couldn't just make it stop. I just wanted it to stop, you know?
So you were brought to safety, and eventually you raised some more money, and I don't know why you did this, but fixed up the boat again.
Yeah, went back into business.
Went back into business, even further in debt. Got it across the Atlantic, and in the West Indies is where it finally went down on you. Can you just describe your last hours aboard this boat?
We were going from Trinidad to the British Virgin Islands, my wife and I sailing the boat to bring it up for charters, and it was perfect weather. It was so nice out. It was flat, calm, and glassy. You could see the tracks of the flying fish, their little tails, you know, going through the water on the surface. And we saw a little squall up ahead, and we thought, oh, that'll be nice. We'll be cooled off a bit by some rain. That'll be great. But we went into that squall, and within 1 hour, we went from that flat, calm to 10-meter seas mixed in with some 20-meter seas, you know, over 60 feet, these seas. And I didn't think it was possible. It wasn't forecast on the radio. It wasn't reported even on the radio after we were in it for 6 hours. And our 90-foot boat went up off of this 20-meter wave and launched into the air. We just went airborne with a 200,000-pound 90-foot boat. And we crashed down and buried the front half of the boat. It just disappeared into the water, which I had never imagined seeing on something that big. And then we popped backwards like a cork, and then we were hit broadside by a wave even bigger that we didn't even see that picked the whole boat out of the water and dropped it with such force that it cracked through half-inch steel plate at the bottom of the boat. It was incredible. And I understood finally that you don't get to use your safety gear. When things get bad enough, there was no way to get into a life raft in 30-foot seas with 60-foot seas mixed in, all coming from a range of 50 degrees, like individual teeth and breaking, where they're dumping thousands of gallons of water onto the deck from different angles. There's actually no way to get into the life raft. So I was completely convinced that we were dead in a way that I can't really explain. I just knew that we were going to die. And so it wasn't exciting. It just felt sad. It felt sad and calm that, well, we're dead. And my wife felt the same way. So we didn't panic or anything. We just knew we were dead, and we both felt sad about that. And we went through that for 6 hours. But 6 hours was really just the longest time of my life, because knowing that we were dead the whole time and that I was just going through the motions. I was holding on and steering into the waves like I was supposed to, but we could hear steel walls inside the boat breaking underneath us. We could hear everything breaking inside. And it was such an awful time. I felt so sad that I brought my wife into this. That was my main sadness, is that I had, you know, was causing her to die, and it was unnecessary for the stupid boat business and boat.
Where were you when you saw the boat go down?
Well, we didn't sink until a day and a half later, and it's a circus, the things that happen in between. I mean, incredible. But we were just short of repair in Norman Island, the British Virgin Islands. So we sank within sight of the British Virgin Islands, and there was all kinds of fiascos.
But you were in a life raft, essentially, watching all this.
Yeah, we were in our dinghy watching it. And I got flipped out of the dinghy and banged my knee and had knee surgery and stuff. But it was oddly euphoric, having survived. For 3 days, we felt elated afterwards.
This really brings us to the kind of the tin tacks of this. You shared your father's fate, except it was probably the volume ramped up to 11. It was much more terrifying what you went through. Your father was kind of just had mishaps, really, compared to what you went through. Absolutely terrifying thing. And a shattering experience, I would have thought, for anyone. Why were you feeling strangely elated?
I guess it was release. You know, we'd worked so hard, and it was always such a struggle. We were always behind on money and behind on time. My wife says she was so happy to see it go down because it meant she'd never have to work on the varnish again. She'd never have to polish the stanchions.
So it was
with
die, you
metal.
Bastard, but die, was it?
Yeah. But after our 3 days of elation, it was mostly just surviving. You really feel honestly so elated when you survive. If you're convinced that you were going to die, when you do survive, you just feel thrilled for quite a while. But then the depression afterwards is so low because we realized that that boat was our home and our business. It was everything. It was our lives. It was our future. And it was all gone. And what the strange thing is that it didn't hurt our marriage at all. That wasn't a challenge for our marriage. Later, when we bought a house and had a mortgage and had trouble paying the monthly bills, that almost tore us apart. Just the thing that everyone has to do, we were like ill-equipped to handle. But the losing everything on the boat, it was okay in that way. But it was a deep depression afterwards thinking that, God, what do we do? And what I was amazed by is that our lives did reshape. We did move on to better lives, actually. And this is what I wish my father had known, that if he had just stuck around, his life would have reshaped. You know, the life is redemptive in that way. You do get second chances. If you just stay, even if everything has been destroyed, your life is no longer going to be the way you knew it before. It actually will reform into something which oftentimes is better. And so I've been extremely lucky. We lost everything twice, and both times something better came out of it afterwards.
You said you had this feeling of an appointment with something, that when it got to that point where you'd lost everything and the business had failed, that you'd have these suicidal thoughts like your father did. Did you, though?
No, that was the biggest relief, is that I thought that after losing everything, and it was in the earlier disaster in the business that I felt also persecuted in some ways because of legal things and insurance things. And I felt that the future was this awful thing that was massing with pressure and nothing to look forward to. And then I realized after a couple of days I'd had no thoughts of suicide, like no thoughts whatsoever. And so I'd finally found that moment that I think unconsciously I'd been pushing toward and wanting in some awful way. And I was just so surprised to find that my brain just didn't go there. It just wasn't wired that way, that I'm not my father and that I'm just never going to think of suicide. Like, it's just not the way I think. So I suddenly felt free of that legacy of 20 years. And it wasn't the end of the legacies of my father's suicide. I still felt anger at him. And I had to fail a bit more and get a bit older to finally have the rage go away. And then what's left over at the end is just love. I mean, what's underneath rage is always love. You know, I was so angry at him because I felt it should have been enough that I loved him and that my sister loved him. That should have been enough reason for him to stay. And that's why I was so angry for over 30 years. But finally, when that ended, I could see that I just miss him, and I wish I could have him back, and I would gladly hand over the books to have my father back. You know, I just that love I had for him when I was 13 is just kind of frozen, and I just miss him, and I you know, I'm sad that he missed my sister's wedding and her kids and, you know, all these things. So I just wish he had stuck around and seen what new life would have formed for him.
And to see you become a successful author too. David, it's been lovely having you on the program, and what an extraordinary story. I won't get over that anytime soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.